The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. In a previous talk, we saw how God made a covenant with his people at Mount Sinai. It was like a wedding ceremony. After this, God called Moses to go up Mount Sinai again. Joshua went with him. There God gave Moses his blueprint for his tabernacle home and instructions about the priests and the Levites. The eternal holy God, the uncreated creator of the universe, was going to move in and live with his people here on earth. Moses had assured the people that he would return from his meeting with God, but he and Joshua remained on the mountain for weeks. Where were they? Moses was the one through whom God spoke to Israel. Had he vanished? Was the nation's contact with God now lost? Only weeks before, God had bound himself to his people in a solemn blood bond. How was it possible even to contemplate that God might abandon them? All the people had to do was to trust God and be patient. Instead, an angry mob bullied Aaron into making them gods, gods whom they could see with their eyes, gods who could lead them. So Aaron made a golden calf, and Israel proclaimed, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." Aaron built an altar before it. He announced, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." A bull was often used as an idol in the ancient Near East. From Aaron's use of God's name, Lord, the Hebrew here is Yahweh, it seems he was associating Yahweh's presence with this idol. This broke the second commandment. The people themselves seem to be associating this calf with pagan gods. This broke the first commandment. The people offered sacrifices and ate and drank and partied. As one writer puts it, it is Genesis 3 all over again. Just like Adam in the Garden of Eden, Israel disobeyed God and took their lives into their own hands. When Moses and Joshua came down from the mountain, wild revelry confronted them. In his fury, Moses smashed the tablets of the law, but the law had already been broken in the hearts of God's people. Moses ground the golden calf to powder, mixed the dust with water, and made the people drink it. In Numbers chapter 5, we read about a similar ritual that was administered to a woman suspected of adultery. That ritual may well provide the background to what Moses did here. Israel had certainly committed spiritual adultery. Moses cried out, "Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me." The Levites responded to his call. They executed judgment, slaying around 3,000 men, and the Lord himself sent a plague among the people. God's people mourned. Moses interceded with God. He besought him to forgive the people and lead them into the promised land. And then he asked God, "Please show me your glory." God answered, "I will make all my goodness pass before you, and will proclaim before you my name, the Lord." And God said, "While my glory passes by, I will put you in a cleft of a rock, and I will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I will take away my hand, and you shall see my back, but my face shall not be seen." So Moses took two new tablets and climbed Mount Sinai again. God put Moses in a cleft in a mountain. God covered him with his hand until he had passed by. Then God removed his hand, and Moses saw God's back, but Moses could not see his face. And God proclaimed, "The Lord, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation." God renewed the covenant with his people. Moses wrote God's law on new tablets. He returned to the camp, his face aglow from exposure to God's glory. With the people chastened and the covenant renewed, work on the tabernacle began. Within a year of their arrival in Mount Sinai, the tabernacle was completed. God filled it with his glory and made it his home, and the priesthood and the sacrificial system began to function. After celebrating their second Passover, Israel broke camp and set off for the Promised Land. There must have been an electric sense of anticipation. God led them to the wilderness of Paran, about 150 miles northeast of Sinai. But on the journey, God's people complained. This wasn't the first time. Before they even got to Mount Sinai, we read, "And the people grumbled." Then 5 verses later, we're told, "And the whole congregation of the people grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." These grumblings were only the opening barrage. God's people tested his patience for 40 long years in the wilderness with their complaints and rebellion. Only divine patience, born of divine love, could endure it. God had delivered Israel from grinding servitude in Egypt. He provided food and drink for them in the wilderness, and he himself was present with them, visible as a pillar of smoke by day and fire by night. We read that the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. The living God, creator of heaven and earth, was their deliverer, their companion, their guide, and their provider. How could they complain so bitterly? While they were encamped in the wilderness of Paran, Moses sent 12 men, one from each tribe, to spy out the promised land. The spies returned bearing grapes, pomegranates, and figs, proving the promised land to be a paradise. But in the land there were powerful people living in fortified cities. 2 spies, Caleb and Joshua, were confident that God would give them victory over the people who occupied the land. But the other 10 weren't, and their report won the day. The people wailed, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become a prey. Would it not be better for us to go back to Egypt?" The people spoke of choosing a leader to take them back to Egypt, to the old familiar life of servitude. They had completely forgotten what a bondage it was. God had promised that he would clear the land of its inhabitants. The Canaanites themselves were cowering in dread of God and his people, as we learn from Joshua chapter 2. Israel's unbelief was rank disobedience. God had cared for his people in so many ways. He gave them a constant, visible token of his presence with them, and he was taking them to a new land where untold blessings awaited them. Yet his people slandered him with this insult: "Because the Lord hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us." This was blasphemy. How could they possibly say this? God couldn't allow such rank unbelief to continue like a cancer in his people. So he decreed that every man eligible for military service would die in the wilderness. Only the women, the children and young people, and the Levites, who were not eligible for military service, would enter the land alongside the faithful spies Caleb and Joshua. For the next 38 years, God's people wandered in the desert. The Bible reveals little about that 38-year period. Year followed year in dreary succession, until all the men of war had died. And even after nearly 4 decades in the wilderness, God's people still complained. An angry mob confronted Moses and Aaron, crying, "Why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink." Our patient God responded to his thirsty people's protests in love. All Moses and Aaron had to do was to speak to a rock, and out of it water would flow. But Moses, this aged and faithful servant of God, had borne with this rebellious rabble for nearly 40 years. He had had enough. In the heat of rage and exasperation, he shouted at the people in sharp rebuke, "Hear now, you rebels, shall we bring water for you out of this rock?" He spoke as if he and Aaron, and God too, for whom Moses spoke, were sick and tired of the people. And notice that he said, "Must we bring forth water?" thus ascribing this miraculous provision to his and Aaron's own power. And rather than just speaking to the rock, he whacked it, not once, but twice. In his grace, God simply wanted to give drink to his people. But Moses, through his anger, presumption, and disobedience, had misrepresented and dishonored God. So God barred Moses from entering the promised land. In fact, every rank and division of God's people rebelled in the wilderness. Adam failed to resist Satan's temptation in the garden. Now God's new mankind, Israel, failed their time of testing too. We might well ask at this point, could this inveterately rebellious and faithless mob ever conquer the land and be God's instrument of blessing to the world? By now, any shrewd observer would have concluded that it was quite impossible. But God had promised it would happen, and God never breaks his promises. So now God's people resumed their journey to the promised land. Israel asked the king of Edom if they could pass through his land, but the Edomite leadership refused their request. So God's people had to circumnavigate the land of Edom instead. Then the Canaanite king of Arad attacked them and took some of God's people prisoner. At this moment, the tide turned. Israel made a vow to God and said, "If you will indeed give this people into my hand, then I will devote their cities to destruction." And God delivered the Canaanites into Israel's hand. God's people destroyed them and their cities. Then God's people took their journey through territory east of the Dead Sea. They crossed the Zered Valley. They skirted the land of Moab and crossed the Arnon Valley. Famous victories against Sihon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan, gave them possession of lands east of the River Jordan. Their final camp was in the plains of Moab, on the east bank of Jordan, overlooking Jericho. God's people were poised for conquest. Balak, the king of Moab, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. The Moabites were overcome with fear of the people of Israel. So the Moabites consulted with the elders of the Midianites, a neighbouring people. They hired a prophet to curse God's people. This prophet was called Balaam. But Balaam didn't curse Israel. Instead, he blessed them in some of the most wonderful oracles in the Old Testament. Balaam saw God's people as a vast nation, without misfortune or trouble, invincible, living in a verdant, well-watered paradise. And in his final prophecy he declared, "A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab, and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed, Seir also, his enemies, shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly." This astonishing prophecy has King David in view, but it also looks forward to the promised Messiah, who would crush the head of the supreme enemy of God's people, Satan. But with this sublime prophecy still ringing in our ears, we are shocked by what we read next. Israel descended into sexual immorality and idolatry. This incident was just a foretaste of what was to come in the centuries that followed. God plagued the people. 24,000 died. There, in the plains of Moab, Moses preached to God's people. The book of Deuteronomy contains the transcript. Moses reminded Israel of their history. He exhorted them to obey God and reminded them of God's commandments. He told them about the promised land and taught them more about how they were to live there. Moses told the people that when they entered the land, they were to write the law on commemorative stones and confirm their covenant commitment to God. Moses pronounced the blessings of obedience and the curses of disobedience. He summarized and renewed the covenant between God and his people, setting before them life and good, death and evil. Just as Adam and Eve had the life-defining choice between the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, so God set before Israel the life-defining choice of blessing or curse, life or death. Moses wrote the law and ordered it to be read to the nation every 7 years. Then Moses commanded Joshua, appointed as his successor, and the whole nation to be strong and courageous as they took possession of the promised land. For, Moses said, it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you or forsake you. God gave Moses a song to sing to the nation. He sang of God's faithfulness and his guidance and care and provision for his people. He sang too of Israel's rebellion and God's judgment on them. But the song ends in triumph. God would punish Israel's enemies and restore his people. Finally, Moses blessed the 12 tribes. Then, after ascending Mount Nebo and viewing the promised land, this faithful servant of God died. Joshua now took over leadership of the nation. God commissioned him to take the people into the land. Like Moses, Joshua sent spies into the land. They returned and encouraged Israel with these words, "Truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us." The nation crossed the river Jordan. The river was in flood, but God held back the waters, and the people passed over on dry land. It was like another exodus. Notice that they entered the land from the east. That's significant. God sent Adam and Eve eastwards out of the garden. God's people enter the promised land in the opposite direction. They enter from the east. They are, so to speak, returning to paradise. They're entering a new Garden of Eden. All the faithless men of war who had come out of Egypt had died except Caleb and Joshua. But those born during the wanderings in the wilderness hadn't been circumcised. Now, having crossed the River Jordan, the males of this new generation were circumcised. Circumcision was a sign of being in covenant relationship with God. So in being circumcised, they were now committed to obey the covenant obligations. And they would also enjoy the blessings of the covenant, living in God's paradise across the Jordan River. In our next talk, we'll see how Israel conquered the Promised Land, and we'll follow their history to the time when King Solomon became the King of Israel.